Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will happen to President Bush and his senior cabinet officials after January 20th? The president is expected to return to Dallas, work on his library and pet political issues, and perhaps accept occasional highly paid speaking engagements. Those things are, in fact, likely to happen. But my guest today is convinced that a peaceful, prosperous post-White House existence for Mr. Bush and many of his senior advisors would represent a miscarriage of justice and a lost opportunity to censure public officials who ignored multiple laws and allowed the torture of prisoners. So what are the alternatives? Scott Horton is an attorney in New York City. He is also a contributing editor at Harper's. He wrote the magazine's December cover story. It's called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. Scott, welcome to Think.
Great to be with you, Chris.
Your opinion is that senior administration officials committed multiple crimes, or may have committed multiple crimes, but you would focus prosecution efforts on just one, and that is torture. Can you talk about why?
That's right. And I think, you know, if we go through the list, I think surveillance of Americans in violation of the FISA statute is probably a pretty significant one. The issuance of non-bid contracts to contractors who were not capable of performing them while taking away from the ability of the Defense Department to provide oversight for those contracts is another one. What happened in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina is a third. But torture goes to foundation values of the United States. And if we go back to 1776, George Washington, who was then the commander-in-chief before he became president, issued orders to the Continental Army, which is the oldest American institution, instructing that there would be no mistreatment of prisoners. Treat them with humanity, he said, and he absolutely forbade torture, and he spelled out in some detail what that meant. And Abraham Lincoln in 1863 picked up on that theme in issuing orders that again forbade torture and provided for punishment for soldiers who violated that instruction. So beginning in 2002, we saw the Bush administration overturn these ancient doctrines, which were enshrined in law and in international law, the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture. So there's something quite fundamental about that. And we've got to be concerned about our reputation for being a law-abiding nation, for abiding by rules that the U.S. itself advocated. And we have to be concerned about protecting American soldiers in future conflicts, because these rules exist to defend them. But if our country does not have a reputation for adhering to these rules, they will not have the benefit of them.
And the U.S. does, in fact, have a significant track record, not just of prosecuting torture in general and forbidding it in general, but waterboarding quite specifically.
That's right. In fact, if we go back, we can go back to 1903 when there were where there was a court-martial of a waterboarding case coming out of the Philippines of an American Army major. 1968, there was a second court-martial case. There's a criminal prosecution in 1923 in Mississippi. There was another one in East Texas that occurred more recently in the 1980s. And at the end of World War One, the U.S. charged a group of Japanese officers and civilian officials with mistreatment of prisoners, specifically including waterboarding, a whole series of trials that occurred in the Tokyo Tribunal. The U.S. sought the death penalty and obtained the death penalty in a number of these cases.
Is it important that any investigation at least consider the utilitarian question of whether torture works in the first place?
I think the answer to that is yes. I believe that the next step is really not for a new president to come into office and to direct that people be prosecuted. That would be ridiculous, and that would be inconsistent with our traditions and values. We don't need criminal prosecutions that are directed by a president. We have a process that ensures that justice is done, and that process involves having a thorough investigation and development of the facts first, and only then would a competent, trained prosecutor make a decision as to whether or not charges should be brought. And in this case, I think we need a commission that's going to study all these background facts, fully develop them, and I think it's got to look at the question of the utilitarian issue surrounding torture. The Bush administration claimed over and over again it worked, it helped make America safer. What I hear consistently from people in the intelligence community is that's not true. In fact, I've tracked through specific claims that President Bush made about it being useful, and every one of those claims falls apart when you get deep into the facts. You discover that it didn't result in new intelligence that was reliable being discovered. But I think we need a nonpartisan commission of experts that gets into this and renders some verdict on that question.
How would you make decisions about who would be placed on those commissions?
That's an important question, because the commission's worthless unless the public has faith in the independence and the integrity of the people who are involved. In the past, we have gone through a process of appointing a bipartisan commission, which is to say that the seats on the commission are divided up, and there are six Democrats and six Republicans, and we say maybe the president and the Senate and House majority and minority leaders make appointments. I think this is a complete mistake, because this ensures that the process is completely politicized, and what we need is for it to be depoliticized. I think we need people who have deep expertise in intelligence gathering, with the military, with the medical profession, people with background in ethics. They all need to be represented on this commission. Now, the way you get to having people who are qualified while going through a political appointments process is, I think, what they did in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. That is, they had a pre-commission of experts that was designed to vet and recommend a pool of candidates who were pre-qualified, and then the political appointees could pick names from that pool of candidates, but not from the country as a whole. That worked pretty well.
What kinds of qualifications beyond people's familiarity with the issue, I guess, would you want these people to have?
Well, I think, for instance, you do have to have someone who has deep experience in the intelligence community, who understands the process of interrogating individuals and what works and what doesn't work, and in evaluating that information. I think you have to have someone who has a background in diplomacy and understands our international treaty commitments and how they're interpreted and applied. I think you have to have someone who has a career background as a prosecutor. I think we'd be making a mistake if we didn't have someone who was a prominent religious figure involved who can provide an ethics perspective. So those are the sorts of backgrounds that are essential to put together a commission that would have credibility.
Scott Horton is my guest. He is an attorney and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He's written the cover story for the December issue called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. Let's assume that you have a commission and at some point it recommends charges be filed against a number of individuals within the administration. This is all for the sake of argument. What difference in international relations would the outcomes of those trials make, assuming that either all parties were found guilty or none were? What would be the takeaway from the exercise for the rest of the world?
Well, I think it's a very important question, and in fact, there are prosecutors around the world, especially in Europe, who are looking at that issue right now. The question, simply put, is, does the U.S. actually enforce the prohibition against torture? And it matters for purposes of what we call universal jurisdiction. That is, crimes of war are different from ordinary crimes in that they can be enforced by every country around the world. But there's a presumption that one country, namely the home country of the people who are involved, has the first responsibility to enforce them. And if it fails to do so, then other countries can step in and take some action. So I think if there were a proper criminal investigation and action on the basis of professional recommendations, that would lead other countries not to begin criminal proceedings involving Americans.
What do you think the chances are that an international criminal board could be formed in order to address a question like this?
Well, we have the International Criminal Court, of course, which sits in The Hague, but the U.S. has opted out of it. And I think most experts who were involved in the formation of the ICC feel that this is a good example of the sort of matter that should never come to the ICC. I mean, the ICC is great in dealing with small and even medium-sized powers, but in order to work and work effectively, it has to command the support and respect of the major powers, especially the United States. And that means that it's very, very difficult for the ICC to take on and deal with a case that's politically sensitive involving the U.S. So I don't really see that as a feasible alternative. The U.S. should take on the responsibility of dealing with this issue, and that responsibility has to start with a full exploration and development of the facts.
Do you think there's a political will for this, or are people ready just to move on within this country?
That's the question that the Obama transition team is dealing with right now. From what I understand, they're torn in two directions. I mean, one is I understand that President-elect Obama does not want to take any steps that appear to be retribution or that suggest a vindictive nature towards the prior administration. On the other hand, he also feels that the torture issue is not simply a policy difference between himself and the Bush administration, that there was some very, very serious wrongdoing. And I think there's a lot of concern about the future, you know, generations ahead, because we have a system that is based on precedent. This having been done and there being no accountability for it means that presidents down the road in the future will draw on what President Bush did as precedent, and they may be tempted to do the same thing. That, if nothing else, that is the major fact that's pushing towards some sort of further action, probably not a criminal investigation and prosecution, but probably, yes, a commission of inquiry that will lay bare all the facts.
Yeah, you say doing nothing ratifies torture and ratifies the failure of people to of the people to control the actions of their government.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I think essentially if nothing happens right now, the torture techniques and tools that were used by the Bush administration will be viewed as a part of the inherent powers of the president for the future.
I wonder, though, if there's any way, regardless of how many bipartisan members you have on a commission that is looking into this, how there's any way to avoid the perception that this is suddenly the Democratic Party has control and they're taking a Republican administration that is now out of office and sort of kicking it while it's down. Regardless of the facts of the investigation, this becomes a repolarizing factor in the United States, doesn't it?
Well, you know, that's the suggestion we're hearing in newspaper columns and in editorials. Especially op-ed pieces in the last couple of weeks. Now, if we go and look at the bylines of these pieces, we see in every case I can find the complaints and that charge is being raised by an individual who would be right in the crosshairs of the investigation. So certainly those people who were involved in the interrogation program have very good reason to want to oppose some sort of commission of inquiry. But it seems to me ridiculous to suggest that you can never compose a commission that will go about doing things fairly, that our entire country is red and blue and partisan, and this is all about retaliation. I mean, I think the 9/11 Commission demonstrated very, very well that you could have a commission that rose above that and worked very effectively.
We have an email from Bill in Dallas who says, for any pension-entitled members of the Bush administration who may be found guilty of anything serious, what possibilities exist to strip away their pension, health, and Secret Service benefits?
Well, I'd say starting with the president and the vice president, you know, one of the issues is, in fact, the impeachment question. One of the questions has historically been whether you could impeach an individual after they have completed their term of office. And the answer is yes. There's clear precedent established for that in the middle of the 19th century that, you know, impeachment and actions can be taken to strip away entitlements of various sorts, pensions, funds, medical benefits, and so forth. And that would be, you know, one, I'd say, a relatively mild form of punishment that could be meted out. And I think we need to note as well that, you know, the wrongdoing here might involve misleading Congress. It might involve lesser things than war crimes.
Scott Horton is my guest. His article in the December issue of Harper's Magazine is called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. We'll return in just a moment and invite you to get on the lines to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Scott Horton is my guest. He's an attorney in New York City, and he is also a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine. He wrote the magazine's cover story for December. It's called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Scott, is there a potential to do damage to the dignity of the office of president if you involve a president in something that could turn into criminal charges?
Well, the constitutional theory we've operated on is that the president has immunity from criminal prosecution during his time in office, and the only alternative is impeachment, which congressional leadership decided not to pursue here. So the criminal process really only kicks in after the conclusion of his presidency. I think one of the major questions here, of course, is whether there would be a prosecution or a criminal investigation of President Bush or Vice President Cheney or others. Who amongst the people who were involved would bear the most responsibility? And I say, talking to professional prosecutors who've looked at this question, there's a very strong sense that, in fact, the people who face the most severe risk here are the lawyers who were involved, John Yoo, David Addington, Alberto Gonzalez, because they're the people who should have been saying, this is unlawful, you can't do it, and instead they were rendering bogus opinions saying that everything was legal and fine.
And some of that behavior is what tells you that this was, in fact, a deliberate decision not to follow the law as opposed to a misinterpretation.
I think that's right. In fact, Attorney General Mukasey, my friend of 20 years and former law partner, has made a series of speeches in which he said, look, they were all just relying on opinions of the Office of Legal Counsel, and these opinions were issued in good faith, and I'm aware of no facts that would suggest otherwise, and to which I can just say that Michael Mukasey hasn't studied the facts, because there are plenty of facts that suggest otherwise. Specifically, the facts are now increasingly clear that the program was in place before lawyers wrote opinions about it, which means that these opinions were written for purposes of providing cover for a decision that had already been taken. That means they weren't researched and rendered in good faith. So that's just one point, and I think there are a number of others.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. How difficult do you think it would be, Scott, to gather sufficient evidence for an investigation that would just sort of look into the question of the use of torture in the Bush administration?
Well, we had seven separate hearings in the House Judiciary Committee. In fact, I worked as an expert consultant for the committee in setting them up, in which this issue was probed, and there was these were all stonewalled by the administration. But after January 20, the situation is different, because then there'll be a new president in the White House, and that president, of course, can issue instructions to the agencies involved saying, you are required to cooperate with the investigation. You're required to turn over and declassify documents and so forth. So I think after January 20, there's a much better odds of making headway and exposing the facts. We'll still have individuals who will have their Fifth Amendment concerns and may refuse to testify or may only testify if they get some sort of grant of amnesty up front. I mean, you always have those complications. But I think after January 20th, we'll have the real opportunity to get to the bottom of the major questions about what happened.
We have an email here that says, I heard President Bush say after 9/11 that he would consider his presidency a success if America was not attacked again during his term. How do you reconcile his thoughts on torture to prevent terrorist activities against Americans? I feel that if this is what it takes to keep me and my family safe, then so be it.
Well, that's one major question, is whether or not the introduction of these techniques has made people safer. And I'd say the available evidence and, you know, views I hear from people inside the intelligence community say just exactly the opposite. In fact, if we look at recruitment information that's come in the form of National Intelligence Estimate recently about recruitment for al-Qaeda and allied organizations, the fire has been relit, and they are at least the strength they were at on 9/11, maybe more. They're rebuilding their capacity, and nothing has fueled their efforts to reignite more effectively than torture. It has damaged the reputation of the United States around the world, eroded our relationship with our allies, and allowed them to recruit thousands of new followers. So has it made us safer? No, it's made us much less safe. And that's the broadly shared assessment of leaders in our own intelligence community.
Would you compare the potential risks and benefits to President-elect Obama and his status and his political career of simply outlawing torture and delineating the fact that it is illegal and will not be practiced by the United States, as opposed to saying that but also pushing for a serious investigation into what went on during the Bush years?
Well, of course, the problem is that torture was always outlawed. In fact, the Bush administration never challenged that fact. I think there are more than 40 occasions on which President Bush publicly said, we do not torture, or America does not torture. And if you look at the testimony that Alberto Gonzalez gave before the Senate, he would start out saying torture is against the law. So what they did was really, I'd say, shifty, disreputable legal work of defining torture into oblivion, so that things that have historically been viewed as torture were suddenly no longer defined to be so. With that having been done in the past, the risk exists in the future that any future president can do the same thing. It's a question of fidelity to and respect for the law. So I think that's the fundamental dilemma that President Obama faces. It's not a question of whether or not torture will be policy in his administration. The answer is no, and that the answer would have been no for John McCain too. For that. On that point. The question is what happens in generations in the future when we have future administrations come in.
If the U.S. does nothing about this, is there a potential for a foreign national court, perhaps the place where one of the alleged victims resided, to come in and press charges itself?
It's no longer potential. There is, in fact, two cases now pending, one of them in Milan in Italy, being pursued by the chief counterterrorism prosecutor, who I interviewed a few months ago. He has charged 26 American civil servants. They're mostly CIA agents, a few diplomats also, and one military officer in connection with the Extraordinary Renditions Program. And that prosecutor told me in an interview that he had also prepared a criminal investigation looking into senior policymakers in the Bush administration. And there was not going to be action on that until after January 20th. But after January 20th, there may be further indictments. And then in Spain, we've got the same thing. We know there's a pending investigation by the Audiencia Nacional, which is the Spanish National Security Court, focusing on American policymakers relating to Guantanamo, because, of course, there are a number of Spanish subjects who are held in Guantanamo, which is what gives them jurisdiction over it. So I think it's probable that there will be further proceedings.
If those prosecutions went all the way to the top, how would they compel, say, Dick Cheney or George W. Bush to appear in court there?
They won't. And in fact, I wrote a piece for the New Republic that was called Travel Advisory, in which I sort of sort through all this. I say basically, look, the U.S. is not going to extradite these people. The U.S. will not cooperate with them. It doesn't matter who the administration is in Washington. So basically, the dilemma for the individuals involved, and it's, you know, roughly 60 senior figures in the Bush administration, is that they can't really travel outside of the United States, or they have to be very, very careful where they travel. Certainly, they can't travel anywhere in Europe, and they have to be concerned about other countries that might extradite to the Europeans as well. As long as they stay at home in the United States, they're fine.
Is there a potential backlash of support for the United States if somehow you had a former president or vice president or senior cabinet official traveling to Europe on vacation and sort of gets abducted and taken to court?
I think so, and I'm concerned because I think the principal objective we have to have in this entire exercise is building respect for the prohibition on torture and abiding by the rules of war. And I think that means that you really don't begin a proceeding if it's going to undermine public support in the largest and most powerful country in the world for those rules. So if the Spaniards were to grab Dick Cheney and begin proceeding, well, I don't know, Dick Cheney's public support is now registering in single digits, so maybe that would be applauded by the American public. But other people in the administration, I don't know, it might very well provoke negative reactions. So I don't think it would necessarily be a good thing. But it is it's a serious risk that's out there that has to be taken into account.
Scott Horton is with us. His new piece in Harper's Magazine for December is called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Tammy in Dallas. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. I had a question about just the large number of people that are that have been affected by sort of the Bush administration war on terror. It seems such a great number of people in the U.S. that sort of feel their reach in a way, and I'm just wondering is there a larger plan somehow? Is it just about the war on terror? Is there something else going on in the U.S. that somehow, I'm not quite sure what my question is, but I kind of feel that so many people felt the administration's tenacious grip, college students, housewives, children. So I'm just kind of wondering what's going on.
Well, the war on terror is different, of course, from the Vietnam War in that we didn't have large numbers of people forced into military service in connection with the war. And I think Bush and the senior advisors, especially Vice President Cheney, felt that they would have much greater latitude in conducting the war as long as they didn't have a draft. And they had only a very modest consequence for the American people in their war effort. But I think Americans are waking up now to the fact that this has had much broader consequences for them than they originally envisioned. I mean, one of them we see right now in the financial institutions meltdown. A large part of that problem has to do with the fiscal misadministration of the administration, for the last 6 to 8 years. And $2 trillion in spending relating to the war on terror effort has had a very profound effect on our economy, and it has weakened us, and I think allowed things to deteriorate to the level we see now, where we're certainly in a severe recession, and it may wind up being a depression before it's all over. So this is having impact on people all across the country. The surveillance programs that the administration introduced likewise have more impact than most people realize. But of course, the torture issue and the detainee issue really only affects a fairly small number of people, and I have to acknowledge that. So it's really more about principles and concepts than it is broad effect on the American public.
We have an email from Neil who writes, as a former prosecutor, I'm happy to volunteer. Might Obama not pardon Bush?
Yeah, the pardon question is hanging out there right now. In fact, I was speaking with a couple of real Washington insiders this morning about this issue. There's a sense that there's a chess game going on right now between President Bush and Barack Obama. And we saw it in the pages of the Wall Street Journal yesterday when an article was floated saying that Bush has decided he really doesn't need to pardon people who are involved in the torture program because they're protected already by Department of Justice officials. And, of course, Bush is looking to see what Obama is going to do and how he's going to proceed. And he has the right to issue pardons before his last day. And beyond that, then the pardon power will pass to Barack Obama. And I think there's a strong sense amongst most people who've studied this that pardons are a part of the answer here. That is that there's certainly a large number of people who were involved in this program who may face criminal liability who should be effectively pardoned if they're not shielded under the law. And one thing I think would happen if Bush does not exercise his pardon power, I think it's still more likely than not that he will before he leaves. That then President Obama, if he appoints a commission, one of the things he'll ask the commission to do is to recommend to him how he should use his pardon power with respect to the people who are at risk here.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Ron in Richardson. Hello, Ron.
Hi. By the way, excellent topic. I'm glad you're covering this. I think another story, and I'd like your guest to perhaps comment on off, and I'll take that off the air, is that it seemed to me one of the untold stories was that there was a tremendous amount of pushback by our military to these policies, which they knew were illegal and immoral, specifically the judge advocate's office, I think in many cases, objected vehemently, and numerous attorneys, to their credit, have resigned from rather than participate in the show trials at Guantanamo. I think these men are very committed, men and women are very committed to the protection of our country, and I think they know from personal experience and their training what will make us safe. And the myth that torture somehow protects us is pernicious and just not true. Thanks a lot. I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Scott?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. In fact, that's exactly one of the recommendations I've made. We tend to view this all in terms of accountability in a negative sense, but it's also appropriate for the new president to acknowledge and applaud people who stood up firmly for the principle of rule of law. And I put way up that list people like Alberto Mora, who was the general counsel of the Department of the Navy, and all of the four uniformed service TJAGs, the Judge Advocates General, who stood very, very bravely against the administration, as did many other senior uniformed officers, and within the Department of Justice, also many people. And the Central Intelligence Agency, I've been collecting information on this for some time, but it appears that there's several hundred CIA agents who resigned or took early retirement, saying that as a matter of principle, they would not be involved in this program. And they're to be applauded, frankly. I think the CIA should try and recruit them and bring them back. They're exactly the sort of people who should be serving in the CIA.
Email from Gabriel asks, does President Bush have the authority to issue a blanket pardon that would absolve himself and the rest of his administration of any legal liability?
That's a very tricky question, because if you go back and you look at some of the debates involving the framers, they say that the president shouldn't be pardoning himself, that that would be inappropriate. And if the president issued a class-based blanket preemptive pardon, it would presumably have some consequences for himself. And so that's one of the, I think that's one of the lines of legal attack on it. But if you look at the text of the Constitution itself, it's pretty open-ended. He has this power and he can exercise it as long as he's in office. And the only limitation on it, which is rather ambiguous, is that he may not exercise it in connection with an impeachment proceeding.
We are talking to Scott Horton. He is an attorney and also contributing editor for Harper's. He wrote the cover story for December. It's called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. We'll be back in just a moment. And if you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this afternoon with attorney Scott Horton. His piece in the December Harper's is called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Scott, I know that one of the models that you favor for investigating this sort of issue is based on South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Can you talk about what the advantages are of that model?
You know, the South Africans, and I think Latin Americans had the same situation. They dealt with a testy political situation at the time the issue came up, where there was a sense that if someone were to proceed straight to prosecutions, it would upset the political balance, the stability of the government. So the idea was that there would be a trade-off of the truth for pardon. If people came in and came clean and told their story about what happened, and they demonstrated complete candor, they would receive effectively a pardon from the commission. Now, you can't work that out exactly with our system because the pardon power rests with the president. We can't delegate it to a commission here. But the commission could exercise the power of advising the president about the use of his pardon power. So that was an effective technique. But I think in South Africa also, they took their time doing this. They took several years. And in the process, the public in South Africa was educated about their recent history, what had happened and who had been involved, and particularly what their government had done. So it helped form a public opinion consensus inside the country about what should be done.
Is there anything President Bush could do either now or after January 20th that would obviate the need for this?
I think his exercise of his pardon power, of course, is a key consideration here. And if he were to issue a blanket preemptive pardon, that would I think, by and large, take care of the question of criminal prosecutions, but it wouldn't take care of the question altogether. I think there would still be a very, very strong demand for the facts to come out. And I think in a certain sense, actually, if President Bush issued a pardon, it would make the decision much easier for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. And then there would still be the matter of educating the public about what had happened and giving people a chance to sort of work through what had taken place.
Exactly. And it wouldn't have the sharp edge of prosecution to it. At that point, it's just exploring and developing the facts, establishing a historical record that everybody can agree to.
Would that deflate people's ire over the situation to the extent that they didn't want to bother with it anymore?
Well, I think there's certain people who are very worked up about it and think that there should be criminal accountability. I mean, I hear that more than anywhere else. I hear this from uniformed service members. I hear a lot of military prosecutors telling me that they're angry that it's just a bunch of NCOs who are scapegoated here. They think that the people who made the decisions should be made to stand trial and do some time in prison the way now about 18 NCOs have been forced to do time in the brig.
We have an email from the Reverend Terry McClellan in Carrollton who says, definitely recommends the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and says, less focus on the legal process and the defense prosecution actions, which sometimes obscure the truth, and more focus on the truth. Use forgiveness as a foundation for healing. It worked for Jesus and it worked in South Africa.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I mean, I think knowing the facts and the people understanding what actually occurred and who was responsible for it is the really important thing. And criminal accountability of individuals is, you know, it's important for a just society, but it's not nearly as important as the truth coming out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Denton and speak with Priscilla. Hey, Priscilla.
Hi. I just had a question. If President Bush or Vice President Cheney were to personally benefit from their association with Halliburton or the Carlyle Group or other kind of organizations that were involved in the war effort, would they be subject to prosecution for war profiteering?
Well, there is actually. There's a war profiteering statute on the books that was put forward in the Lincoln administration during the Civil War and is still there. But it requires a high and direct showing of abuse. So the fact that they had some indirect benefit isn't going to be enough. And in the case of Vice President Cheney, of course, you know, he continued to get some payments from Halliburton after he left under an annuity arrangement, but that's not enough of a direct connection to justify any criminal accountability for him in connection with corruption charges involving Halliburton. But, you know, I'm not ruling something out. So if facts were to be developed, and I've been told repeatedly in the last few days that there is a big probe within the Justice Department right now that's focusing on Dick Cheney. I haven't been able to figure out what it's about. But if it is about Halliburton, you know, maybe there will be some charge brought at some point after he leaves office.
I do understand with regard to Halliburton that the annuity agreement was made before he was even in office. This was
That's
not
correct.
Something that came about after the war on terror started.
That's correct. So that it antedated, and I think that provides, you know, a defense in this case. So, you know, I don't really see that as providing a basis to tie him to corruption charges. And, of course, what you've got going on down in the Rio Grande Valley with this indictment there relating to some prison contracts. I've spent some time looking at it and can't make any sense out of it.
Let's go next to Sam in Dallas. Hello, Sam. Hi, Sam. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm sorry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, first of all, you focused on the laws we have in place here to protect POWs like in Guantanamo and places like that and the possibility of criminal charges, this kind of thing. My question is, on the other side of the coin, to balance it out, we have Americans at times, like in Iraq, that are captured or POWs, and after the, what kind of international laws are there in place? Oh, there are some to protect their rights and keep them from torture. And after this is over with, after we get out of Iraq, what are our plans to go in and look for folks that have tortured our people? That's my question. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And, you know, if you talk to people like Colin Powell and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I mean, they address this issue directly. And, you know, we don't advance the interests of detainees so much because we're concerned about them and what happens to them. We do it because we're concerned about what happens to our soldiers and wanting to be sure that our soldiers get the benefit of these protections, especially under the Geneva Conventions. The soldiers in Guantanamo don't have the benefit of POW protections under the Geneva Conventions. They have a much lower level of protection, which is Common Article 3, which basically gives them protection against torture, but not too much more than that, some procedural safeguards as well. But I think the big question in the background is, if for our soldiers to have the benefit of these rules, we have to ourselves abide by them. That is the international law standard. And I think there's a lot of concern about what happens to that American pilot 20 or 30 years in the future who's shot down and held in prison by some warring state that we're dealing with, and how is that person going to be treated? The situation that's developed in the last few years puts him in vulnerability, because the other state could very well say, we're not abiding by our Geneva Convention obligations. And I think both Barack Obama and John McCain pledged that they were going to reverse that. And so I think we're going to see that reversed, and the accountability paradigm is part of the answer.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Carol in Mesquite next. Hi, Carol.
Well, hi there. I'm a retired psychiatrist, and I'm absolutely fascinated by this concept. We're talking about a level playing field and everyone playing fair and playing by the rules. And I certainly agree with that, and I applaud you, Chris, for having this particular focus on this particular administration. I remember watching, being almost taken in gullibly by some of the stuff, saying, well, yeah, maybe we should invade, but as time went on, I thought, no, it was absolutely the worst thing that we could have done. Just the war itself, the war in Iraq. And that's really all that I needed to say. I don't have a particular question except to ask where else can we as American citizens become better informed about these things in addition to the article in Harper's.
Carol, thanks for your call. Any recommendations, Scott?
Oh, harpers.org, our website, where we
keep posting backlog
about this all the time. I think there are a number of others. I'd say the Daily Beast, the Huffington Post, the Atlantic website. There are keen opposition, but nevertheless, they're very, very good covering these issues.
You have, however, found this to be something of a third rail when you've taken this idea on the road. You were told by the NewsHour on PBS, among other places, not to use the word torture specific to the president and the vice president.
That's right. I think in the early years, especially 2004, 2005, 2006, we got very strong pushback from the media. And, you know, the PBS, as I noted, the Jim Lehrer show, I was told, be very, very careful about how you use the word torture. You know, you really can't be directly attaching it to the administration's programs. I heard the same thing from CNN. But we saw a complete turnaround about that in the course of this year. You know, we got down to the presidential debates that occurred, the very first presidential debate. We saw John McCain, first of all, referring to President Bush's program as torture, pure and simple, and Barack Obama picking it up and Joe Biden picking it up. And I think after those debates, the tone within the mainstream media switched pretty dramatically, and suddenly we were hearing people regularly talking about torture.
Which is interesting, because certainly at this point it favors your perspective on the whole thing. Several years ago it did not, but it speaks once again to that power of public opinion and of the ability of people, right or wrong, as history will decide, to influence each other.
That's right. In fact, I recently asked one of the network producers about their take on the issue, and she explained it to me this way. She said, you know, in 2004, 2005, 2006, it was a partisan issue. The Democrats said torture, the Republicans said not. But in 2008, the Republicans said torture, because the final three Republican candidates all embraced pretty much the same view. So it was no longer an issue of partisan differentiation, and that meant the news media was perfectly free to use the label torture with respect to these programs.
Could that have been done had the sort of party that was associated with the people that were accused of this not chosen to pick up and take that word on? In other words, is there any way that the opposition, who thought, people like you who thought it was torture years ago, could have gotten the word out in some other way?
You know, it's the sensitivities of our mainstream media and how they cover things. and they want to fend off charges that they are politically biased. And I think this is one of the ways that they do it. You know, they avoid the use of language that is offensive to one side, and they don't even want their guests to come in and use that language.
If we go ahead with some kind of commission that investigates this in a pretty significant way, will the effort have been worth it if we don't believe that it would absolutely prevent future administrations from using torture?
I think that it would result in any event in the public and in policymakers being much better informed about the issues and the options and the arguments. So it would be a good thing in any event. But I think it's very unlikely that it would not have a prohibitive effect as well. That is, the commission's, I think, going to come out saying these arguments that torture works, that it's useful. I think that's going to get studied thoroughly, and I think it's going to be debunked, because I think you're going to look at specific cases that have been held up saying, we got this benefit. They're going to follow those things back to the end, and they're going to say, no, that's not really true. There was no advantage gained from inflicting torture in these cases. This was intelligence that we already had and had gotten before the torture techniques were ever used. And in fact, when we use torture techniques, we tend to get people to say what they think the torturer wants them to say, and it's not really reliable.
You've communicated the importance of this coming from within so that we as Americans take a really close look at what we believe, what our policies are, what our leaders are doing. Do you think, though, Scott, that the rest of the world believes that we're able to be objective after all that's happened?
I think yes. And I thought it was very, very interesting during the last presidential campaign that both Barack Obama and John McCain saw this issue in exactly the same terms. I mean, John McCain said in one of the Republican debates, this is the defining issue of my lifetime. And when he was pushed on that, he said, yes, because it establishes America's moral leadership. It's right to moral leadership. And the decisions the Bush administration took really hampered us in that. But I think we see already in the reactions to the presidential election around the world that there is a willingness to see that there's a new America there and a new day is dawning. And people are prepared once again to see America in a leadership position. Certainly our historical allies are.
Scott Horton is an attorney in New York City. He is also a contributing editor for Harper's and writes the daily No Comment blog for Harper's Online. You can read his cover story in the December issue of the magazine. It's called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to all your guests.
And to you. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.